case number 09-5246 et al. Securities and Exchange Commission, Puma Foundation Limited Appellant versus Paul A. Bulzerian et al. Mr. DeCaye for Appellant, Puma Foundation Limited. Mr. Hammer for Appellant, David Eric Hammer. Mr. Bulzerian for Appellant, Paul Bulzerian. Mr. Hodges for Appellee Ernest B. Hare III, Ms. Augustini for Appellee SEC, Ms. Rose for Appellee Deborah R. Misholam.
Counsel for Puma Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning. Been in town for less than 24 hours, already caught a cold. Paul DeCaye for Puma Foundation. May it please the court. Puma Foundation is before this court at the behest of Ernest B. Hare, and neither party is a named party in the underlying action SEC v. Bilzerian, which in the district court is a 1989 case stemming from a disgorgement judgment.
Well, they wouldn't have to be a named party, would they, to have?
No, Your Honor, I'm just making the suggestion that we're here today and neither one of them are a named party. And the reason that we are here is because there was a, by way of motion to Judge Lamberth in the district court by Ernest Hare for an order to show cause for Puma Foundation pursuant to a litigation injunction issued for the benefit of the receivership estate back in 2001, why Puma should not be held in contempt for initiating bona fide, legitimate litigation against Mr. Hare, who borrowed money and refused to pay it back. That initiation of litigation happened in the state court in Florida and also was based upon Florida state law. Ultimately, the district court required Puma to respond in writing. Puma responded in writing, raising significant issues of standing, whether or not Mr. Hare had any standing to use this injunction to shield himself from civil liability. An injunction in the district court for the District of Columbia to shield him from liability in a civil case in the state court in the 13th Judicial Circuit in Tampa, Florida. And that is the paramount question for Puma today, is whether or not there is, whether or not there was standing for Mr. Hare to shield himself from civil liability against Puma.
Which is not an issue we have to address if the district court had inherent authority to enforce his order, right?
Inherent in order to enforce a...
Yeah. If the district court had the authority to do it on its own, why do we care whether...
Well, we don't believe that. The district court found the litigation injunction was a product of a motion to show cause for Mr. Bilzerian in 2001 for not obeying the receiver, the order appointing the receiver. As part of that... he was found in civil contempt, and not as part of the remedial measures, he was barred. And at the time, it was more focused about a bankruptcy case. He was barred from continuing on a bankruptcy case or interfering with the receivership. Now, does the court have the authority to enforce its own order? Sure, if it would involve the case of something that involved the receiver or Mr. Bilzerian. Neither is the case in this particular matter.
But that doesn't have anything to do with standing. It just, I mean, well, if he has the inherent authority, then maybe he abused it, but that's not a standing question.
Well, I believe it is a standing question, right? Because if he didn't have he has to obtain jurisdiction.
Well, you just said he had inherent authority. That's where it comes from.
He had inherent authority.
He appointed the receiver, and receiver's an arm of the court. And he has the inherent authority to enforce his orders. Now, as I said, he might abuse his discretion in doing that. He might go beyond the order, but I don't understand why, since you concede he has inherent authority, why we care about standing. Isn't it then just a question of whether or not the order was, this order to enforce the, against this particular litigation was justified?
I don't believe I conceded that he had inherent authority blanket. What I stated in response to the question from the court was, is that he had inherent authority to enforce his orders over the two parties involved in the order. The Securities Exchange, actually three parties, the Security Exchange Commission, the receiver, Ms. Meshlam, and Paul A. Bilzerian. None of them are involved in that transaction between Puma, who loaned money to Mr. Hare and expected it back, and Mr. Hare, who didn't pay it back, thus initiation of litigation. So while I would agree that certainly the district court had jurisdiction and had the ability to enforce its own orders, its own civil contempt order over Mr. Bilzerian and the Securities and Exchange Commission over the parties involved, here we don't have that. We don't have that nexus of connection. Otherwise, anybody could go through the federal record or through PACER and find an injunction that they like and try to get a judge to enforce it on their behalf. And that's just not how they work. I would like to reserve my last 2 minutes for rebuttal unless somebody has any other questions.
All right, that's fine.
Notice the light.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appellant Hammer? Mr. Hammer?
Good morning, Your Honors. In the well-publicized 2003 case of Cobell versus Norton, Chief Judge Ginsburg stated as follows. Clearly, however, the district court did not intend its decision to be without effect. The exceedingly strong words it used in finding the defendants in contempt, in particular, its statement that Secretary Norton was unfit, suggests the court intended the adjudication and accompanying opinion to serve as a reprimand to Secretary Norton and Assistant Secretary McCaleb. Examining this sanction in light of the principles set forth in Gompers and Bagwell, therefore, it is clear the proceeding was and should have been treated as being for criminal contempt. In Cobell, this court reversed a contempt order of Judge Lamberth because this court found that Judge Lamberth intended the order to be punitive rather than coercive, and therefore criminal under the Gompers-Bagwell analysis. This court's opinion in Cobell has not been criticized or distinguished by any court in the nation until Judge Lamberth, the very judge who was reversed in Cobell, entered his order denying my motion for reconsideration of the order on appeal. But in reality, the order on appeal is not at all distinguishable from the order in Cobell. In Cobell, Judge Lamberth wrote scathing language, the only purpose of which was to malign and punish Secretary Norton. 6 years later in this case, Judge Lamberth ordered that the grievance committee of the district court shall transmit a copy of the opinion and order to the Florida Bar for consideration of disciplinary action against Hammer for his conduct in this case and the Florida cases filed in contempt of this court's order. The order that Judge Lamberth ruled I violated bars Paul Bilzerian and his aiders and abettors from commencing any proceeding in any court other than the district court. My clients were entities whose adversaries alleged that my clients were aiders and abettors of Bilzerian. I argued that my clients were not aiders and abettors of Bilzerian. I prevailed in one of those arguments but lost the other arguments, and as a result was ordered to withdraw from the litigation that Judge Lamberth ruled was contemptuous. I obeyed immediately and promptly. However, I continue to be punished by the order on appeal. As this court explained in Cobell, citing to Gompers and Bagwell, civil contempt is ordinarily used to compel compliance with an order of the court, although in some circumstances a civil contempt sanction may be designed to compensate the complainant for the losses sustained. By contrast, criminal contempt is used to punish, that is, to vindicate the authority of the court following a transgression rather than to compel future compliance or aid the plaintiff. Clearly, Judge Lambert's referral of me to the Florida Bar was not requested by any party, and it was not entered to compensate Mr. Hare, the complainant in this proceeding. Accordingly, no party has objected to the relief which I requested on appeal, that the language referring me to the Florida Bar be vacated. Despite my multiple requests, Judge Lambert did not conduct a single hearing before entering the criminal contempt order against me. Respectfully, this honorable court should reverse Judge Lambert's contempt order as having been entered without due process of law.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
If your honors have no questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you. Appellant Bill Zarian.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, which gives me 2 minutes. The only issue I have time to address is the issue with respect to the way the district court has, in my view, converted a disgorgement judgment into punishment and into a super monetary judgment. Essentially, I don't think there's any dispute. The district court has ruled that the disgorgement judgment that was entered some close to 20 years ago, which was also the subject of a consent judgment in January 2002, wherein my wife and, family members and others assigned and transferred to the receiver all the assets that basically were claimed I had a vested interest in. There has been no claim in the last essentially 9 years that there's any other asset at that time that was not transferred over. Judge, the district court has ruled that that doesn't matter, that this disgorgement judgment goes on for however long it takes to pay $100 million and that there is no limit. Inability to pay doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference whether all of the assets in the world I could strip naked here and turn that over to the government. It wouldn't make any difference whether I had a cent, a penny, whatever. The obligation to pay goes on indefinitely. If the purpose of a disgorgement judgment, which this court has said many, many, many times, is remedial, and the purpose is to prevent unjust enrichment, to prevent a party from keeping ill-gotten gains, if that's the purpose, that has to have been accomplished with stripping a person of every asset they have, exempt, non-exempt, no bankruptcy protection, no nothing. Now, to go on from that thereafter and turn it into a money judgment that cannot be satisfied unless it is paid in full, what purpose could that possibly serve other than punishment, essentially a super fine? And if that's the case, then in my case, that's a violation of the Double Jeopardy Clause. And given the $100 million amount, I would also argue it's in violation of the Excessive Fines Clause. I think that's,
all right.
Is that on the 2 minutes or the four?
That's fine. You understand, do you not, Mr. Bilzerian, that these were issues that you had raised earlier?
Your Honor.
And this court at that time had rejected them, and that we three judges here on this panel are bound by that decision.
No, Your Honor, I beg to disagree, although I know that's what the SEC has argued. But if you will look at what the SEC asked this court to do in 2002, their issues, and I'll read from their brief in 2002, were whether Bilzerian's 1991 bankruptcy eliminated his obligation to pay the disgorgement judgments. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's over. That's done. No argument. Second issue, whether the district court erred in appointing a receiver over Bilzerian's assets when he refused to provide a full and accurate accounting describing the extent and location of his assets. Done, finished, over, not at issue here. The page 9 of the SEC's brief in 2002 stated, Bilzerian's main argument is that his 1991 bankruptcy precluded the district court from entering the August 21, 2000 contempt order and the December 22 receivership order. Done, gone, not an issue here. Now, I know that the SEC would like it to appear that the court has decided these issues and basically this court can't go redecide them. The court's response in 2003 to those issues was, Bilzerian asked this court to find that he satisfied a disgorgement judgment as a matter of law. That's it. There was no discussion about what issue, what it was, and I don't care about those issues. This 20-year-old bankruptcy case, I'm not saying satisfied the disgorgement judgment. I'm not saying that the appointment of the receiver over all my assets satisfied the disgorgement judgment. I'm asking this court very specifically whether the district court's extension of this disgorgement judgment now, okay, accomplishes any remote purpose, okay, that one could consider remedial. If it's not punishment, I don't understand what punishment is.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Appley Hare.
May it please the court, Jeffrey Todd Hodges for Appley Ernest Hare. The issue of standing has been called of paramount importance by Appellant Puma Foundation. Of course, we maintain that standing was not necessary for the exact reason acknowledged by the court, which was the district court always has inherent contempt power to enforce its own orders. What they're asking is that Hare pass some sort of threshold in order to bring to attention of the district court a violation of those orders. The if this court decides to impose such a standard, we argue that Hare has met it, and he's met it in two different ways. First, his show cause, his initial motion for show cause order clearly established all three elements of the Lujan test for standing, legally cognizable right or interest. It's being invaded by the other side. He established that he had been sued in violation of that injunction. He had a legally cognizable interest in not being sued in violation of the injunction. Causation is the second element. Causation between the injury and the conduct complained of. Well, clearly the violation of the injunction was the cause of the lawsuit, and the third element being likely redress by a favorable decision. We now know that he did in fact receive redress by a favorable decision. His legally cognizable right stems from two places. The district court's injunction itself bars Mr. Bilzerian and all acting in concert with him or all participating with him from filing any lawsuit in any jurisdiction without the permission of the district court. By itself, we believe that confers on every defendant in litigation brought by Mr. Bilzerian or at his direction or in which he participates the standing to bring a violation of the injunction to the district court's attention. District court clearly has the power under the All Writs statute to issue the injunction and then therefore has the power to enforce the injunction via its use of the contempt power. Our research disclosed no reported cases directly on point on this standing issue raised by the appellants, and there are certainly no cases holding that a person such as Hare does not have standing to seek a show cause order under these circumstances. Cases cited by the appellants in their briefs, such as VACO and Moore v. Tangipahoa, they contain no such holding. VACO said New York can't pursue damages on behalf of an individual who was personally injured by violation of injunction. The Moore case simply held that a white female teacher who wasn't alleging race-based discrimination was not a beneficiary of an injunction preventing race-based discrimination and therefore could not seek a contempt order for its violation when she was claiming a gender-based injury. The closest case that I could find on point is a case called Sullivan v. Highland. It's not cited in the briefs, and in fact, I only found it yesterday. Citation is 647 F sub 2nd 143. It's a district court from Connecticut case. In Sullivan v. Highland, the Connecticut court was considering imposing a pre-litigation injunction similar to what it had done in the original Martin Fragona case. But it considered the scope and enforceability of such an injunction as part of its opinion. And what the district court said was whether just the parties seeking the pre-litigation injunction should be beneficiaries of it, whether every potential defendant of this particular abusive litigator should be deemed a beneficiary of it. And the court said, we believe it should extend to the benefit of all potential defendants. And that's at page 160 in that case. The court said, it's very difficult to even apply the concept of standing to this situation because the court should have its own, its inherent power to enforce such an injunction. And typically, the person who is going to raise this issue has already been named as a defendant in a lawsuit. And so he's already got the standing necessary to bring it to the court's attention. They said, even if a motion for protection could be treated as some sort of counterclaim, it would in every case meet the Lujan test. So we believe that the rationale stated by the court in the Sullivan v. Highland case should be adopted by this court and that Hare be determined to have standing. The second element that gives Hare standing stems from his status in the case below as a party. Mr. Hare was sued in 2002 by the receiver, Ms. Mashulam. That case continued for a number of years and, in fact, appeared once before this court on an appeal. It was ultimately settled in late 2005 and carrying into 2006. And as part of the settlement with the receiver, Hare assigned a portion of a judgment that he held against an entity called OHLP. OHLP was a Bilzerian affiliate. Hare obtained a judgment against it, assigned a portion of his judgment to the receiver, condemned the receiver's obligation to pay money to OHLP from her settlement with Hare, and offset those two items. So essentially, that process was undertaken to prevent Hare from paying cash to the receiver, who would pay it to OHLP, who would then pay it back to Hare in partial satisfaction of his judgment. Rather than go through that circular process of cash transfers, this condemnation process was entered. OHLP, Puma, Bicoastal, Mr. Bilzerian, all of them were given notice, the opportunity to object. None did. Judge Lambert ultimately approved the settlement, condemned the receiver's obligation to pay OHLP the money, offset it against Hare's judgment, and the settlement was finally completed. Shortly after that was done, OHLP filed suit to try and attack Hare's judgment, saying it was procured by fraud, he couldn't use it in his settlement with the receiver. Puma and Bicoastal sued Hare and said, hey, we're the owners of that judgment, not you, Hare. You couldn't use it in your settlement with the receiver. In other words, these three Bilzerian affiliates were trying to set aside Hare's judgment with the receiver through state court litigation. This is exactly the kind of behavior that Judge Lamberth was trying to prevent when he instituted the injunction against Mr. Bilzerian and those acting in concert with him. Hare sought dismissal from the state court based on the existence of the pre-litigation injunction and the noncompliance with it. That was denied by the state court. Hare then brought it to Judge Lambert's attention. Judge Lambert decided that Mr. Hare did have standing to bring it to his attention, found the parties in contempt for acting in concert with Bilzerian, had plenty of evidence before him with which to do so. In fact, Mr. Bilzerian signed the very document you submit to the court with the lawsuit and physically filed the lawsuit that Puma was a plaintiff in. And so Judge Lambert found them all in contempt, ordered all the litigation dismissed, and that's where we are today. We would ask the court to affirm the rulings. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Hope Augustini for the Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Bilzerian's contumacious refusal to provide an accounting is what landed him in this receivership, and contumacious refusal to abide by receivership orders are not going to bring him out of that receivership. He has failed to provide an accounting, his refusal to pay anything on the judgment, his refusal to abide by the receivership orders, filing actions outside of the receivership jurisdiction, and other attempts throughout this period to thwart the receivership, none of those equate to satisfaction of the disgorgement judgment or compliance with the receivership court. Mr. Bilzerian essentially wants passage of time to serve as a substitute for his obligation to substantiate his assertion of an inability to pay anything on the judgment. We are not asking that he pay, turn over tomorrow $100 million. What we are asking and expecting is an accounting to substantiate his assertion that he has presently no ability to pay. Mr. Bilzerian also suggests that the receivership order in 2001 essentially fixed, for purposes of collection of our judgment, the amount of assets, Bilzerian-related assets, that would be available for that collection. This is a post-judgment collection proceeding, and other courts have held that the commission may seek to seek assets whenever acquired to satisfy a judgment. Unless the court has any further questions, I believe we've answered the bulk of this in our brief. Thank you.
All right, appellee for the receiver.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Kristen Rose, counsel for Deborah Mashulam, who is the court-appointed receiver below. None of the issues raised today were addressed in the receiver's brief, so the receiver will rest on her brief unless the court has particular questions for her.
I just had one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the record show why the receiver did not join in the motion filed by Mr. Hare? And
that is not a part of the record, Your Honor.
All right.
Does the receiver, I'm curious about the receiver's view about the receiver's relationship with the court. Does, obviously I'm not going to ask you to go beyond what you want to, okay, but the receiver didn't file a motion, as Judge Rogers just said. The receiver did a report on this, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Uh-huh.
And the receiver in this particular instance, and particularly with...
Has a receiver ever filed a motion with the court of any kind?
Yes, Your Honor.
What are they? What?
The docket spans...
As opposed to a report?
Yes. The receiver has moved on multiple occasions. I don't have count on the top off the top of my head for orders to show cause, contempt proceedings. The receiver has filed motions with regard to the assets that she identified. Mm-hmm. The receiver filed the motion that led to the settlement for...
Are those motions... Is the receiver authorized to file them because the receiver has Article III standing, or just because the receiver is an arm of the court? Do you see my point?
I understand your question. It's not something...
You haven't thought about that?
Yeah, it's not something we have evaluated.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's the counsel for Puma Foundation.
Your Honors, one of the things that I did not get to in the first part is that the receiver settled all claims and fully released Puma from the receivership action, which was the focus of Judge Lambert's litigation injunction and order finding Mr. Bilzerian in contempt in 2001. That has not changed. That is all about and Mr. Hare, through his counsel, had admitted that he was also sued by the receiver, and he settled. So we have two parties who were sued by the receiver, settled their claims, and then went back to Florida, essentially. And again, the receiver did not join in Mr. Hare's original motion, nor did the receiver join in Mark and Alan Yaffe's motion, who they're tangentially connected to this matter, but they chose not to file a brief or participate in oral arguments, but another set of parties who used the receivership order or the and the litigation injunction to shield themselves from liability.
Thank you.
Unless there are any questions, I'm out.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant Hammer.
Your Honors, as no one opposed my argument, unless Your Honors have any questions for me, I'll rest. Yes.
Thank you. All right. And Mr. Bilzerian.
Your Honor, the SEC, I will say they do an excellent job. Ms. Augustini and I have been litigating for almost 20 years now, and she's excellent. However, okay, she's distracting this court. Let me read the issue she presents in her brief. Okay? Whether Appellant Paul Bilzerian may relitigate the question whether his obligation to pay disgorgement terminated either by his filing for bankruptcy or, in the alternative, by the appointment of a receiver over his assets. Interesting? Same issue of 2002. It's not the issue here. She did that to me in 2002. I'm not going to let her get away with it this time. And what she really, even though she said to the court, we want a sworn, you know, accounting for his assets, I have no assets. I've said that over and over and over. I've said it under oath. I don't know what more I can do. The court doesn't believe me. There's nothing I can do about that. What we can say is that 9 years since millions of dollars were turned over to the receivership in 2002, as opposed to her saying nothing, millions of dollars, okay, since then, not an asset, not a one, has been identified. I don't know what more to do. I guess I can eventually die, and then I guess somebody can say, well, I guess you really didn't have anything else. But this is the real issue, is whether, as she says in her brief, okay, and the real story. Page 5. The receiver is entitled to collect from Bilzerian's future assets until the obligation is paid, or until the district court terminates the receivership. However, she goes on to say, but even if that happens, the commission can still collect until it's paid in full. That's it. Now, if that's a disgorgement judgment, I don't understand disgorgement. And everything this court has written about disgorgement makes no sense to me. And so if that's not punishment, if that's remedial, as I said earlier, I don't understand punishment. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will take the cases under advisement.
Stand, please. This honorable court will adjourn until Thursday morning at 9:30. Thank you.